Nicholas Hilliard is a co-founder of The Corner House, a UK research and solidarity group focusing on human rights, the environment, and development. Before forming The Corner House, he was co-editor of an environmental magazine, The Ecologist, from 1976 to 1997. Hilliard was actively involved in the Ilisu Dam campaign. Nicholas is the author of a paper entitled A Crumbling Wall of Money, Financial Bricolage, Derivatives, and Power, a very compelling document of some 60 pages which demystifies the credit crunch by making transparent some very complex trading mechanisms and more broadly serves as a critique of neoliberal market practices.
With some colleagues, I went to a meeting in Rome, which was a meeting put on by an industry group about export finance. And there again, they were all talking about derivatives, and they were all talking about these state-of-the-art, masters of the universe means of parceling up risk and spreading it around and offsetting risk in such a way that they were talking as if the issue of risk had just completely evaporated, that there was no risk any longer. It was not an issue any longer. So I started looking into this a bit, and then as we were doing it, I mean, more and more of the groups that we work with in solidarity, but groups on working, for example, on mining, on pulp and paper, on forestry, on land issues, were beginning to talk about new actors coming in, new companies and forms of finance coming in to fund very destructive projects, and a lot of these were things called hedge funds. Or the hedge funds were speculating on the shares of new companies, and those shares were rocketing up. So the hedge funds made a lot of money very short term and got out, and the shares went down again. But it ended up with the companies having a lot more money to play with. And this wall of money was being created through financial speculation. So because those we worked with were asking, well, how do we try and stop these hedge funds from affecting our lives and livelihoods? How do we lobby against them? How do we campaign against them? We began to look into that whole area of hedge funds, private equity, boutique investment banks, and of course the derivatives market. And what we discovered, it wasn't just us, but reading the Financial Times and so on and so forth, you know, you begin to realize there was a whole new world out there of finance, a shadow banking system completely unregulated, that within about, from the years 2000 to 2007, 97% of loans were provided by banks. By 2007, about 50%. The rest were being provided by the shadow banking system. And because it was unregulated, because, you know, it was very opaque, you couldn't track down who the shareholders, a lot of the traditional ways of working on these issues were cut off to activists. So that's why we began to look into it. And of course, then the credit crunch came, and the rest is sort of unfolding history.
Perhaps you can clarify in simple terms, some of the mechanisms that are used in shadow banking, just to give a couple examples. Like,
the first thing maybe is just to talk, if I could talk for a moment about derivatives.
Yes, definitely.
Derivatives are financial instruments whose value is based on is derived from the underlying asset. It isn't the underlying asset itself. So, I mean, to give you an example, if you wanted to make money out of oranges, you know, traditionally you would make up money by either growing the oranges, selling them, and making some money. Or you might have a shop and you sell the oranges and you make some money. Or you might have a juicing machine and you set up a small stall and you make some money off juicing. A derivative makes money out of oranges by speculating on the rise or fall of the price. Mm-hmm. So it's an instrument that allows you to speculate on the orange without owning it.
Okay.
And you can make money whether the price goes up or whether the price goes down. Okay. And that's completely new, really, in financial terms. So it doesn't matter whether you're not investing any longer in a company because you think that, you know, long term, mm-hmm. it's value is going to increase. It's going to increase production. It's going to bring new jobs, blah, blah, blah. And the share value will go up. You can make money if the share value goes down. In fact, you make a lot of money if the share value goes down. So derivatives enable you to make money on the underlying value of an asset. You're speculating on the price. Recently, I mean, what's happened is that companies like mortgage providers, for example, have been making mortgage loans to members of the public. And in order to keep on expanding the market for mortgage loans, they've been taking those loans and they've been packaging them up and they've been selling them to another company, which they set up in normally a tax haven. So they don't,
Cayman Islands,
Jersey, you know, there are Mauritius, there are thousands, there are thousands of tax havens. They set it up there for reasons to do with evading tax. Once they've set the company up, they sell the package of mortgages to that company. The company then issues a derivative, a bond in this case, that gives the people who buy the bond the right to the income stream on those mortgages. So they don't own the mortgages. They don't actually own the loans, but they have the right to the income stream on it. And that's done through this process of a derivative. And that vehicle is called a special purpose vehicle or a structured investment vehicle.
Okay. And oftentimes those SPVs are then owned by the actual entity that set them up in the first place, because it's sort of like a way of shifting the risk to somewhere else.
That's right. I mean, if you're a bank, because of new rules that have come in on banking, you've got to keep a certain percentage of your assets of assets against your liabilities. So if you want to reduce your liabilities, what you do is you put the them into a special purpose vehicle, and normally they're off your balance sheet. They no longer belong to you,
yeah.
Although the vehicle may well belong to you. Mm-hmm. So ultimately it does belong to you.
But
on your balance sheet it doesn't show up.
Okay.
And one of the reasons for the credit crunch is that, you know, thousands of these special purpose vehicles have been set up. Derivatives have been sold on the income streams from them. No one knows who's got those derivatives. People have then sold other derivatives, which are called credit default swaps, which are unbelievable. I mean, they are basically instruments that allow you to speculate on whether or not that particular vehicle is credit worthy or not. So it's like it's like me taking out a bet on whether your house will burn down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't own the house,
and you have no interest in whether it stays up or burns down.
In whether or not it burns down or doesn't burn down. That's the only interest I've got in it. So, on top of these special purpose vehicles and the derivatives that they've issued, you've got other derivatives that are betting on whether those derivatives are credit worthy or not, and it's just an endless porridge of different derivatives, and no one knows which ones are credit have value and which ones don't. And that's one of the reasons why banks have been very reluctant to lend to each other, because they've found that they are holding a lot of very bad loans on their books. What's happened, really, is that as the state particularly has withdrawn from public housing and has put the provision of housing more and more over to the private sector, and it's become more and more incumbent on people to actually try and take out a mortgage and buy a house in order to provide for their own old age, because the state's withdrawn from pensions and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So mortgage companies have been selling more and more mortgages. They've taken these mortgages and they've packaged them up. But because they've also been going out there, each time they're packaged up, they get a new tranche of money to go out and try and get people to take mortgages with. They've been going out to people whose income really does not sustain a mortgage.
Yeah.
And these are known as subprime, the subprime market. I mean, it's an incredibly eugenicist word because it tends to be poorer people, people from people of color in many instances, more marginalized communities, and so on. And the brokers that are selling the mortgages are going out to, or were going out to communities, offering mortgages of 125% of the value of someone's income. And they were saying, you know, look, package all your debts together, we'll give you a mortgage, you can pay off your debt, and don't worry because the house price will rise.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an assumption that prices of houses would go on and go on rising. Now, when you've got a whole mass of some quite good mortgages, from people who definitely can pay off, and some people who are much riskier and may well not pay off, who wants to buy the risky ones? So what they did when they packaged them together was they came up with a mechanism known as tranching.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they tranche the loans. That is, they slice them up.
Yeah, tranche is from the French word to slice. Yeah.
That's right. And they'd slice them up. And they'd sell the least risky loans, would get a rating agency, which is an agency which looks at the risk of a default, and they were paying the rating agencies, so the rating agencies had a interest in actually coming up with the answer that they wanted, and they would rate the one tranche as AAA rated, very very secure, mm-hmm. and they'd sell that off to pension funds and so on. Those pension funds would be the first to get the income stream. They'd get the first bite of the income stream. Then there would be another tranche called a mezzanine tranche, which would be riskier mortgages, and they'd sell them off to other investors, but investors prepared to take a bit of a risk. And then the third tranche, which is the really risky mortgages, were sold off to hedge funds and others who were prepared to take a high risk because the income they got much a higher income than the ones who were taking the lower risk
mm-hmm.
tranches. And then, of course, all of them started selling them on to other people or taking on other derivatives to pass on the risk and so on. There's the comedian Mark Thomas who's doing a show around the financial crisis at the moment. He's got a very nice way of putting it. One of the people who did this process of what's known as securitization,
mm-hmm.
you take your mortgages, you sell them to an SPV, and it's known as securitization, was David Bowie. And David Bowie securitized his entire backlist of albums, of songs. And he made about 50 million. He sold bonds. You could buy Bowie bonds, and you would, with that Bowie bond, you'd get a right to the income from the royalties from the songs. You didn't own the songs. He still owned the songs, but you got the right to the income. And he got 50 million up front. Nice lump sum tranche from doing this. But it's like, you know, you could have bought The Laughing Policeman, or you could have bought Ziggy Stardust. You know,
yeah,
and they're all bundled in together.
So the best and best known Bowie, and then the least esteemed Bowie
exactly.
would be in all the same
in the
package.
All in the same package, and I think that's quite a good way. It made a lot of sense to me. That
that is a very good analogy. The funny thing about all of this is that it's legal. None of this is illegal. I guess, what is your response to the ideas that the government needs to step in and reform, or that there needs to be more policing, internal policing by the financiers?
I think it's worth remembering that up to the 1970s, a lot of the derivatives that are being used today were banned. They were illegal in the US, and certain derivatives were illegal in France and in Britain and elsewhere. And they were basically treated for what they are, gambling.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they are. They're bets. But those who wanted to promote them went to immense lobbying efforts and marketing efforts and calling in favors from other traders and so on to set up a market and to get the rules changed. And the rules were changed and a derivatives market has grown.
Mm-hmm.
One of the main uses that people have and attractions of derivatives, I mean, one of them is to get loans off your book and so on. But another attraction is that they're an incredibly useful way of getting around regulation. There's a derivative that's known as a swap. So, I mean, say you're in Japan and you've got a fixed an interest rate of 2%, but it's a fixed interest rate. And I'm in Britain and I've got an interest rate of 3%, but it's a variable rate. It may suit me to swap my interest rate with your interest rate, okay? My interest rate that I'm paying with yours. And that's known as a swap. And these sort of swaps were used in the 80s, for example, and 90s, particularly by the Japanese insurance market,
mm-hmm.
which was not allowed to buy shares in companies.
Hmm.
And so what they did was they borrowed money from banks in Canada because it was perfectly legal in Japan to borrow money mm-hmm. for an insurance company to borrow money. And the money was borrowed in return for a derivative on the Tokyo Stock Exchange. So they came to hold shares via a derivative rather than directly investing. So they got around the rules. And when the market in Tokyo went nosedived, a lot of the insurance companies went bankrupt. So they've used derivatives in many, many forms to get around the rules. The recent last year's speculation on food prices, a lot of that was the use of derivatives in markets by traders in markets that they not legally weren't allowed to deal in or speculate in, but by using a derivative, they got around that rule.
At one point in your article, you mentioned that Eurozone governments also used derivatives to get around obligations in the Maastricht Treaty. And I was just wondering, I mean, if these are the governments that people are looking to regulate this market now, how likely is it that they're going to, you know, regulate it for social good if they themselves have used the derivatives to get around regulation?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, you know, it's very interesting that, you know, the people that the governments are now looking to come up with new forms of regulation are exactly the people who have got us into the mess in the first place. My own view is that these derivatives are unregulatable, completely unregulatable. They're always vulnerable to what Nicholas Taleb has called a black swan event. You know, I mean, there's this famous analogy that he came up with, you know, that until white people went to Australia, the Europeans all thought that there was only a white swan, that swans were all white.
Mm-hmm.
When they went to Australia, they discovered that actually there are black swans as well. Okay? And there's always some event, some risk that you haven't calculated for.
Yeah.
And that when it happens, because of the interconnection of all of these derivatives, it just goes zoomph like wildfire through the system.
Mm-hmm.
And the system is much, much more vulnerable. So it's not, they've talked about spreading risk and getting rid of risk. They spread it in the sense of spreading like contagion. I think there are very real questions about whether or not you really can regulate it to any degree that would be, I mean, really reduce the risk. They're talking about making it more transparent. They're talking about making the amount of money that banks have to keep on their balance sheet much against liabilities higher. These are all things that are useful, but in my view, they're not really going to address the issue because the issue is that these are speculative tools and they are gambling. And if you were to regulate them as gambling, they actually would be far better regulated than if you were regulating them as financial instruments. I mean, my colleague Larry Lohman at the Cornhouse has written another paper on this issue, but more about carbon trading as the next financial bubble. And he sort of points out that the phrase casino capitalism actually trivializes a lot of this, because casinos are very well regulated compared to financial markets. So I think that there's a regulation certainly necessary, but it isn't going to reduce the risks. And actually, there are deeper structural causes for the crisis that which have to do with what the economists call financialization, that really do need to be addressed and which require real change in the way we live and the way we organize ourselves as a society.
But in terms of financialization, what do you mean by that? What is that exactly?
I'm 54, right? When I went to university, the state would have paid my grant. Okay, I wouldn't have had to take out a loan to go to university. It was considered a part of the collective responsibility of society to educate people. It was considered a part of the collective responsibility of society to provide public housing. Last year, there were just 300 council houses built in Britain. Okay, 300. The state, under the influence of free market policies, which, you know, both Labour and Conservative have bought into to one degree or another, has shed its responsibilities for whole areas of social provision that it used to be responsible for. It used to be responsible for pensions, it used to be responsible for education, for healthcare, and so on and so forth. More and more of those services, people are now being expected to pay for themselves. There is only a limit to which the private sector can actually fund that without going to financial markets, without having to recycle the money the whole time. And that's what securitization is basically about. It's doing, you know, it's what Barry did. You're selling, packaging your loans. You sell, you get a lump sum from selling the derivatives on them. You can then use that lump sum to lend more to further mortgages or for building more private sector healthcare homes and so on and so forth. So the withdrawal of the state from whole areas of public service and the de-collectivization of society, if you like, is a fundamental reason for the crisis. And financialization just means that more and more of our interactions with services and with markets is via the financial market. You know, you want a loan, you go to you want to be a student, you go to the bank, you get the money from the bank raises the money on the financial markets. You want a mortgage, you go to a mortgage society. It's not a mortgage society that you've been paying in the old-fashioned way to a mortgage society. You go to a bank, the bank raises the money on the financial markets. So it's this use of financial markets the whole time. And that has real implications for companies. I mean, in order to be able to survive and keep up the share prices, they've got to constantly be looking at the short-term values that are put on their shares within the financial markets. So I would argue that if you're looking at the crisis and the causes of the crisis, I mean, sure, you know, bonuses, approximate cause, and you know, it's outrageous that the 25 top hedge fund managers should have earned more than the entire GDP of Jordan in 2007. I mean, this is outrageous, but that's only approximate cause. The lack of regulation is only approximate cause. Actually, what really is fundamental is that the withdrawal of the state from whole sectors of provision. And I think that raises questions for all of us, you know, like if the state is to come back in, I mean, if nationalisation of the banks and so on what conditions should be set with that nationalisation? What sort of state does one want? Is it the old-fashioned state of the 70s, which is very top-down, very bureaucratic, or is one looking for a new relationship between the public and the citizen? Who defines a public interest? Whose voice counts in all of that?
Mm-hmm.
These are really fundamental issues that actually lie at the heart of the financial crisis. The questions that lie at the heart of any discussion of democracy, and in this case, of democratizing markets.
Mm-hmm. So, do you have any observations on why is privatization so rampant, and why isn't the government providing for education and other things that were happening not very long ago?
Well, I think there were problems with the way the states managed the economy in the 70s, for sure. But there's been a sort of growing myth that the private sector will always be more efficient, that markets are the most efficient way of allocating resources. This is fundamental to the neoliberal agenda.
Mm.
And really what this financial crisis has shown, which is what people in the South, in developing countries have known for years and years, every time they've had a IMF shock package imposed on them, is that actually markets aren't the best way of regulating and distributing resources within society. Markets are a very good way of allowing some people to accumulate at other people's expense.
Mm-hmm.
And over the last 20 years, they've done that phenomenally. I mean, the difference between low-paid workers in the States and a hedge fund manager's bonus is sometimes as much as 26,000 times.
Yeah.
So it's allowed massive accumulation, at incredible growth in the disparity between of wealth, and it's not brought efficiency. It's actually brought much greater risk, which the private sector is now expecting society to pick up, to socialize that risk. And I think that if society is to pick up that risk, for many reasons it has to, in order to the people don't lose their jobs and so on, if it is going to do a fiscal stimulus, really putting money into new infrastructure programs and so on and so forth, then it has to be with conditions. It has to be with a democratization of markets, control by citizens over the financial decisions that affect their lives.
Okay. I guess one response to that I'd have is the myths that prop up neoliberalism aren't so entirely untrue, I guess. I mean, there is some truth to the ideas that, like, governments don't always do the best job. And so I guess
I think that's absolutely right. And I think the real debate is about what sort of governance of the public we as citizens want. And there are some very interesting movements in, say, Italy and elsewhere, where, for example, water companies have been in state hands, very badly run, a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of other issues to do with poor financial management and so on, privatized, equally badly run, a lot of problems with people getting cut off because they can't pay, tariff hikes and so on and so forth. Companies have got into real problems because they've been trying to raise the money via the financial markets, gone bankrupt because of financialization. The companies have then gone back into municipal hands. And there are movements in Italy and elsewhere that are saying, okay, well, if they're coming back into municipal hands, how do we as citizens, as those who are users of the utility of water, how do we ensure governance of those companies that ensures they're under democratic control, that ensures that the pricing is fair, that everyone gets water, and so on and so forth. But more than that, how do we ensure that they're financed in a way that we can still control the company as citizens? So don't let's rely on the central government giving the municipality a budget to run this municipal water company. How about use of things like citizens' bonds, local citizens' bonds, to raise the money, or again, you know, with the nationalisation of banks, does one want just a state bank that everyone has to go to, or are there other forms of ownership of banks that allow for much greater participation and control by those who actually are the depositors? And of course there are. There are hundreds of them have been around for many, many years. Cooperative banks, credit unions, a range of different social institutions where the control of finance is under the control of citizens. And I think, you know, this raises, you know, fundamental questions about what is finance for? Mm-hmm. What is banking for?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like we have to reinvent or invent the wheel. I mean, there are traditions of cooperation, of cooperative movements, of mutual societies, of credit unions and so on that we can build on that are not the traditional state,
mm-hmm.
but which do give democratic control and are in public hands.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we've moved quite far away from that in our present sort of society that we're living in. But
well, yes and no. I mean, actually, you know, these mutual societies are mm-hmm. and have been historically very big institutions in this country, and they still exist. And Nationwide's still a mutual society. You know, there's a cooperative bank. There are lots of examples of this, and I think it's building on those that. Is a real possibility. I mean, I'm intrigued by the notion of the post office, rather than privatizing it, turning it into a people's bank. You know, I mean, the with a discrete social purpose. And I think this is the real key. Who defines the purpose of these banks? And that involves, I think, us all getting involved in the debate.
Given the cyclical nature of capitalism and the fact that there have been depressions before and recessions, I mean, how do you see the credit crunch as fundamentally different, and do you see that the society that will emerge from it as being fundamentally changed, or do you think it's just another slump that there will be a bounce back from and things will carry on as normal?
I'm not an economist, but I think the warnings are there that it could be as serious as anything we've seen, you know, for since the 1930s and possibly including the 1930s. Whether it changes society depends on us and how we organise and how citizens organise. There's a very real risk that the fascist far right will exploit the depression and the loss of jobs and so on, and are already trying to do so, no question about it. But there are other forms of political opposition and political change that could bring real different sort of society, one where there is more of a sense of the collective, not in the old-fashioned statist term of, you know, the state dictating exactly what the collective good is, but a much more democratic sense of who defines it. Public good and how to find new mechanisms, new social forms of organisation that allow citizens to do that, and that includes the collective control of banking and of finance.
And do you see any spaces have been opened up for this kind of action to be taken? And can you give us a few examples?
Oh, there are lots. I mean, we were talking earlier about credit unions and mutual societies and so on. And I mean, there are many examples of people beginning now to set up credit unions as a response to the crisis. And I think, you know, joining those together as movements and linking them to the needs of local communities, and particularly of those who are most marginalised in local communities, is a very exciting prospect. And I think people, you know, the real possibilities there. But there are other movements that are also very active. I mean, the Via Campesina, which is a movement of small farmers and so on, have very much picked up on the whole way that derivatives and speculation were responsible for a large part of the volatility in food prices, which is I mean, devastating for smaller farmers. They've picked up on the way that hedge funds, investment funds, as a shelter from the crisis, are now beginning to buy up land, or see biofuels or carbon trading as a safe haven, or even infrastructure funds as a safe haven. And there are movements that are, you know, active in all those areas that people can get involved in, show solidarity with, and buy, you know, on the ground resistance to destructive projects, land grabs, speculation on food, and so on. A new society is possible, but it's not going to come by top-down regulation. It's not going to come by just bashing bankers because it's easy. They're an easy target. It's the old struggle, the everyday struggle of trying to address imbalances of power, in this instance, within financial markets. And I'm absolutely optimistic that the change could come, but it ain't going to come by us as individuals. It's going to come by individuals joining together and being organized. And I think if there's one real lesson from the 1930s, and there's a very good book by Ian Kershaw on a biography of Hitler. You know, Hitler came to power because he was better organized. The Nazis were better organized politically to capture the political entity that was Germany. And I think, you know, that's a real lesson that who comes out of this particular crisis with what solutions will depend on how active citizens organize, resist oppression, resist unequal power relations, and demand and work for a better world.